So I'll just say a few words about Yvonne's career and then invite her to come up and speak. Yvonne took her degrees in Manchester, Canberra, and Melbourne. Following postdoctoral work at Cornell, she took up work in the Department of Immunology at the Scripps Institute in California. In 1988, she moved from Scripps to her current employer, the University of Pennsylvania, where she is professor in the Department of Biobehavioral Health Sciences. Yvonne's pathbreaking research involves finding ways to enhance the immune system's response to cancers, particularly those affecting women, by using genetically modified Listeria bacteria to mimic an infection in the cancer cells and so stir the sort of immune response that will both kill those cells and stop them from coming back. This work has ramifications for HIV as well. In addition to her numerous scientific publications and citations, her honours include her fellowship of the American Association for the Advancement of Science, her election to the National Academy of Inventors, and her selection by Pharma Voice as one of the 100 most inspiring people in the life sciences industry. Yvonne has been issued over 35 patents, while Advaxis, the company she founded in 2002 to fund and further her work on Listeria-based cancer immunotherapy, has received awards from the World Vaccine Congress, the Farrah Fawcett Foundation, and the Sarcoma Foundation of America. During this same period of time, Yvonne has played an active role in setting up programs to foster the academic careers of underrepresented minorities. She was the architect behind Penn's Postdoc Diversity Fellowships and is a recipient of the Elizabeth Bingham Women's Mentoring Award from the Association for Women in Science. Please join me in welcoming Professor Yvonne Patterson.
Thank you, Paul. So I'm going to take it perhaps a little more practical view of what it's like to be a scientific writer than my esteemed colleague. I don't have the writing prowess that he has. I haven't written any popular science books or popular science articles. I really don't have that talent, I'm afraid. But I thought I would mention how I, as a scientist, compose and what aspects of the scientific writing that I do lead to discovery, the discovery process, which is what we're all interested in here. So as Peter said, you know, as a scientist, I actually spend most of my time writing. It's been a long time since I worked in the laboratory, years. In fact, I think the last experiment I did in the lab was in 1990, I'm embarrassed to say. I went out with a bang because it was published as a full article in Science, and I was the first author of that paper, which meant I actually wrote it rather than somebody in my lab writing it. That was an interesting paper. If I have time, I might tell you a little bit about it, because there was a scientific discovery made as I wrote that paper. But the kind of writing that I do as a scientist is I write research papers, I write grant proposals, I write reviews of papers and grants written by others. So I review papers and grants written by others, and that's a serious writing process. I write book chapters and reviews, and I write letters of references for scientists. Sometimes they're my trainees, sometimes I'm simply evaluating a faculty member from another university as they got promotion with tenure or whatever, but that is part of scientific writing. So of all of those different kinds of scientific writing that I do, I think there are really just two of them where the discovery process comes in. And one is when you write a research paper, and the other is when you write a grant proposal. And I don't know whether people would agree, but in general, I think that's where the discovery comes. So when you write a research paper, papers are written in sections, usually arranged, as Peter said, in the order of the abstract, the introduction, the methods, the results, the discussion and conclusions. That's the order they usually publish it. That's not the order in which I write them. And I think most people do not write them in that order. I usually start with the results. So, as Peter said, you've set up a hypothesis, you've gathered together all the data, you think you've got enough data to make a story, a gripping, compelling story, because when you write a paper, you're really writing a story, but it's not fictional, of course. It's completely factual. And you want to convince other the readers of your story that you have proved your hypothesis, that you've discovered something interesting. So one starts usually with the results, because that's the data you're going to be talking about. And unlike, you know, the example with poetry, you do start with something. You know, it doesn't just come together as you're doing the writing. You have something really factual that you're going to report. So first I write the results. You look through those. You think, yes, I've got enough results here. We're going to go with this. And then I usually do the methods. Because you don't know what methods you're going to put in until you know what results you're going to present, right? And then I usually do the discussion. And it's during the discussion that I think the discovery process. Sometimes it occurs during the results. And in fact, the example that we're going to talk about today, I made a discovery as I was writing up the results and went back and revised the paper on the basis of that. But usually it's during the discussion, because during the discussion, you're taking your work, you're putting it in the context of the field, other people's work, your previous work, and it's a more creative form of writing a paper. It's also a creative part of writing a paper. And it's during the discussion that one often makes discoveries. And an example of that is this last paper that I actually wrote myself, right, from the start, the 1990. Which was published as a full article in Science, was one where I really made quite an important discovery while I was writing the discussion. And the thing is that I think I'm a bit of a sloppy thinker, actually, and it isn't until I write stuff down that I really crystallize my thoughts properly. And when I was doing this study, basically what I was doing was I had thought of a new way of examining the interaction between a protein antigen and proteins. Let's call them like a ball of string, okay, and how it binds to an antibody. All right, and I had thought of this way of looking at that interaction site. The most definitive way of looking at that kind of interaction would be to do a crystal structure of the protein and the antibody complex that's been crystallized, and you study that with X-ray diffraction. That's a very long, tedious process, very informative, extremely informative, but very often you can't get these things to crystallize anyway, they don't form crystals. So I had thought, at this point in my career, I was actually still doing a lot of protein chemistry. I was actually trained originally as a protein chemist, protein biophysical chemist, in fact. My PhD and my postdoc were in that field. And so I had done NMR spectroscopy, and I knew those techniques. And I thought of this idea of using that technique to look at the interaction. And the way I was going to do this was to bind the protein to the antibody, and proton NMR is a way of detecting protons on the surface of the protein. If you put that complex then in heavy water, in D2O, the protons exchange with the deuterium and they become invisible in the NMR spectrum. So you can see how rapidly they disappear. These protons are on the surface of the protein antigen. So I reasoned that the face that was bound of the protein that was bound to the antibody, those protons would exchange much more slowly because they were shielded. So that's, in a nutshell, in layman's terms, that was what I was going to do. Now, I'm not an NMR spectroscopist, really, not a particularly good one anyway, which is why I switched into immunology, which turned out to be quite a lot easier. And so I had two collaborators who were very fine NMR spectroscopists, and it just so happened that they had already plotted the spectrum of the protein antigen that I was using, which was cytochrome C. And I had monoclonal antibodies to this cytochrome C. So I said, okay, we'll immobilize the antibodies on a solid surface so they can't wash off. We'll bind the cytochrome C to the antibody, we'll put it in D2O, we'll then elute off the cytochrome C, and we'll see which of these residues on the surface have been slowed. So we did that, and it worked beautifully, really beautifully. We found a beautiful phase, which from the crystal structure of cytochrome C, we could see all of these residues were together on that phase. It made perfect sense that this was a phase that bound to the antibody. But there was one outlier. There was a residue was on the opposite surface that was slowed. And I knew that when I first saw the data. But I'd kind of, being a bit of a sloppy thinker, I had kind of pushed it to one side. You know, I was very excited about the data I got. It was a totally novel impression. Nobody had ever done this before at all. And I just, you know, glossed over it. I went back to my collaborators and I said, are you sure you've got this residue right? Are you sure this signal is coming from that residue? And said, oh, absolutely, you know, we know what we're doing, you know. Who's the NMR spectroscopist here, right? So I'm like, okay, all right. So then I sit down and they reason. They said, we think maybe there's a long-term interaction going on that's perturbed that residue when it binds, when the protein binds. And I'm like, okay, all right. So then I come and I write the paper, you know, results go well, methods go well, I'm writing the discussion, and then here I come across glutamine 42, that's the residue that was slowed, that was on the wrong face. And I sit there and I look at it and I said, I can't say that this is due to a long-term interaction. It doesn't make any sense. If it were, there'd be other residues around there. They've got it wrong. They have misassigned this residue. Go back to my collaborators, say, I think, really do think you misassigned this. They said, no, we haven't. So in the end, I just wrote, it was puzzling. I didn't know what else to say. I said, this is puzzling. We don't believe it's due to long-term interaction. But we really don't know why it's slowed, and we're going to have to, you know, work on this later. And fortunately, the reviewers accepted that. I was a bit surprised because I thought that they would knock back the paper, but they didn't. I got really very stellar reviews for the paper, and it was a very high-impact paper. It was the last paper I personally wrote as a first author, and I think it made me a full professor at Penn, actually. So. So that's a very good example, both of discovery during a discussion, when you really have to crystallize your thoughts and make a story out of the data that you have. It also tells you something a little bit about collaboration. We managed to resolve the collaboration. They went with me saying it was puzzling, we didn't know what it was due to. They didn't insist on their original idea that this was due to a long-term interaction. Later on, we studied some more different antibodies to the cytochrome C, and they did come to the conclusion that they had misassigned that residue, and that it was a residue that was within the original binding site that we had. But they didn't normally see it in the spectrum for cytochrome C because it exchanged so rapidly they couldn't pick it up. So it appeared as a new dot in the spectrum, as it were, which overlapped with glutamine 42. So that was what happened there. So we'll talk a little bit about the Sturie paper, where I think I made a major discovery in terms of writing up the results, which was unusual, and also has something about collaboration. So another source, I think, of discovery in writing science is when you write grant proposals, because you really have to, you're really basically trying to convince somebody that the work you want to do is good, it's solid, it's going to be important to humankind, if you like. Some of us still care about that who are scientists. And I think that as I phase into retirement now, and I no longer have a lab, I gave up my lab about 3 years ago, I don't have to write grant proposals. In a way, I kind of miss doing it, because it is a way of crystallizing. Yes, believe it or not. You know, remember, I've done this all my life, and quite successfully too. You know, I've probably brought about $30 billion from the NIH over my career, to fund my work. And I kind of miss that, you know, I sort of miss not writing, doing grant proposals anymore. But I think it really does force you to come to terms, actually writing it down forces you to come to terms with whether your hypotheses are convincing or not, and whether the experiments you intend to do will actually either prove or disprove those hypotheses. It's always a bit disappointing when it disproves them, I have to say. So that's really all I want to say. You know, I don't think, apparently sometimes writing critiques of other people's work can lead to discovery. I found that true. But I think the two major ones are writing research papers and writing grant proposals. So maybe I've caught up with the time.
Thank you.